Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for joining us on the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast. I'm really happy to have you.
Thanks for inviting me. I think this will be fun. So,
we actually met through my friend Sarah Burlingame, who is also a friend of the podcast and lives up in Wyoming, and you know her, and she just kept saying, "You have to read this book. You have to read this book." My friend Dan Neal, who is a fantastic journalist and writer, wrote this book about Mormonism. And so, yeah, you sent me the book and I read it and I loved it. And we had you come out to the Sunstone Symposium this summer. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I mean, I was pretty interested to see the diversity of people there. I met fundamentalist Mormons, what I still refer to as the Reformed LDS Church, Community of Christ. So that was a lot of fun. And it was also great to see that there was a great diversity in age. I mean, I expected to see people as gray-haired as me, but there were a lot of young people there too. Like, you know, and there was Sarah there with her booth for Wyoming Equality. So yeah, it was good. I liked it. A little nervous about making a first major presentation at a conference like that. But I thought it went reasonably well, and Brad was receptive, so it was good. And, you know, of course, the big thing is this is a topic that I have a great interest in, and so it was fun to be there.
Yeah, well, let's tell the listeners who don't know about your book, No Forgiveness. Give us a brief sort of plot summary with no spoilers of what people can expect.
Yeah, so the book hinges on the murder of Mike. Grandfather David Stevens Neal in the Teton Valley of Idaho near Driggs. Murder occurred in 1911. My father was just 15 months old at the time his father was killed. So the story starts with a description of the murder, then tracks some of the early newspaper reports about it, the funeral and of my grandfather, where that left my grandmother. And then I wanted to explain who these people were and where they came from. So I went back and talked about my grandparents and their origins. They both were children of polygamous families in Utah, basically in the Weber River Valley, downstream from Park City. And then I wanted to talk a little about Ellington Smith, the killer, who likewise was a child of Mormon pioneers, and he married into a polygamous family, I don't know, in about 1884 or 85, somewhere in there. Everybody grew up in the great Mormon theocracy of the late 19th century and lived with all the federal efforts to suppress polygamy, all the scrambling the church did. Ultimately, my great-grandfather was incarcerated for cohabitation in the Utah Territorial Pen. So then the second part of the book, I zero in on the murder trial and then the term of Ellington Smith in the Idaho State Penitentiary over in Boise. It's an interesting period. There was a lot of change going on in penology in the country at the time. And so I found it really interesting to look into life inside the state pen in the second decade of the 20th century and got to look at some of the changes that were being proposed, some that got through, some that didn't. And then at that time, Ellington Smith made a number of efforts to win a pardon from the state's pardon board to get him out of prison. So that's a general overview of the reach of the book. It I suppose, in terms of decades covered, goes from about the time my great-grandparents emigrated to the U.S. in the 1850s through 1918.
Yeah, when I got the book, I read mostly only history books, especially Mormon history books. And so this was really refreshing for me because it was a history book. It's very well researched. It can read as an academic book. And yet your writing is so good. It also read as a murder mystery. I'm just going to give the blurb on Amazon because I feel like that kind of walks you into it. We're going to be talking and digging into the history. But for anyone out there who is listening, I would definitely recommend the book just for the suspense of it. The story of it's really great. So the full title is No Forgiveness, Family, Polygamy, Murder, and Justice Among Idaho's Pioneering Mormons. And the blurb says, on the morning of July 5th, 1911, D.S. Neal left his house south of Sorenson Creek in Idaho's Teton Valley to irrigate his field. His neighbor, Ellington Smith, mounted his bay horse and rode the short distance to where Neal was working. Shouldering his rifle, a Winchester Model 86, Smith dismounted, climbed over the fence, and stepped into the field. Thus begins the story of the murder of David S. Neal and the subsequent trial of Ellington Smith. Both men were members of the same Mormon ward and came from polygamous families.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see.
So yeah, it's quite the book, and I read it in a day. Like I read it pretty quickly.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. So before we dig deeper into the history and to this story, because we know we have a lot of listeners who like Idaho Mormon history. Shout out to John Dinger and Amanda Komodo out there. Tell us about you. Tell us about your personal background. I know that you're a journalist and an editor, and you grew up in the southeastern Idaho Mormon area. So how did you come to this subject? Are you a Mormon? Do you have a Mormon background?
Yeah, I was pretty deeply in the Mormon culture of the 50s and 60s. I grew up in Idaho Falls. Lived in a neighborhood of comprised almost entirely of Mormon families. You know, we grew up knowing that we were a chosen people, not only white and delightsome, but descended from the faithful pioneers who'd made it to Utah. And you know, I still think of my next door neighbor who had the, you know, the Pioneers' Creed hanging on their walls. You know, the coward never started, the weak died on the way, only the strong made it through. And so you can see, I mean, we were taught that we were pretty special people, and not only brave, but sort of selected. The other thing that I learned growing up there was that Mormons took care of one another. Before farms in eastern Idaho were completely mechanized, I picked potatoes on a state farm near Idaho Falls. You know, we collected fast offerings to feed the poor. So I really developed a sense that Mormons take care of each other. So then contrast that with the fact that every day I practice piano beneath the wedding porch of my grandparents, and I knew my grandfather had been murdered, and I knew he'd been murdered by a fellow member of his ward in Darby, Idaho. And so I was trying to sort through all this myself. So that's my interest in the story has been there for many, many years. I went off to, you know, after high school, and I did attend seminary for 4 years, and I went off to BYU for a year. And around that time that I decided that, you know, the church wasn't really for me any longer. In our family, you know, it seemed like all the women stayed devout and most of the men fell away. So I went off, became a journalist, worked in Pullman, Washington, then in Riverton, Wyoming, and Casper, where I worked for about 25 years. And, you know, in that job. You know, we still occasionally wrote about Western history, and that included Mormon history. All the major trails go through Casper. We got really interested in the 1990s when the church bought the Sun Ranch out near Martin's Cove, you know, one of the great sacred sites of Mormon history. And then we had to track how federal agencies had to figure out how to manage this new Mormon trekking culture that developed out there on South Pass. I mean, there, you know, there were days when there would be a trek with a few hundred, mostly younger people, I'd say teenagers or young adults. But a friend of mine went out and watched one. He said, yeah, he says they're going along. And I mean, South Pass is still quite pristine. And he said, yeah, there'd be a big Winnebago leading the way with speakers playing, you know, great Mormon hymns, you know, oh, come all ye faithful, you know them all. And so we had to write about that. So, you know, you can take Mormonism out of the guy, I guess, but it's still part of my history. And so when I retired about 12 years ago, I decided that I really needed to write this story. I'd been in contact with a number of family members. There was a family reunion in 1992 that really kindled my interest. And all wanted to know more about this murder. And it was about that time, maybe a little earlier, that some documents from the trial came into our hands. One of Smith's great-granddaughters was doing her usual or necessary genealogical research. And this is, I think, back in the early 1970s. And she found out that her grandfather died in Boise. She dug further and found out she died in the pen. Her family had never talked about this. She approached one of her uncles, and he said, yeah, we were just told not to talk about it. So for her, learning about this murder was a new part of her own history. Whereas, you know, I'd grown up with it. I knew all about it, or at least I thought I did. But these documents were great, and among other things, include a transcript of a witness, an eyewitness's testimony before the a lower court in the county seat at the time, where they asked him about the murder. So he provided a full description of exactly what happened, and then there were loads of other documents, court minutes. Stuff that I found really interesting was all the intake documents at the state pen when Smith was incarcerated there in 1912. And then there were a couple of other key documents, including the judge's statement after the trial that was sent to the governor and then forwarded to the warden at the pen. So...
Incredible. Well, why don't we set the scene? Let's back up a minute and set the scene for the listeners about what Idaho was like. In early 20th century southeastern Idaho, we had Mormon families. This is part of the Old West, where it's really changing from frontier to a more modern world, I guess you could say. But it's caught right, to use your word, on the hinge of that. What is life like in southeastern Idaho for families?
Well, particularly in the upper Snake River Valley, I mean, the Mormons really, the first big expedition to the Teton Valley didn't happen until 1889, where a couple of the Driggs brothers organized a group of people that took a wagon train up there. I mean, at that time there was no railroad service, I think, north of Pocatello. And so they took, you know, truly an old style wagon train up there to settle the place. And, you know, there was land available, land to be homesteaded. They were there working, you know, with horses, wagons, you know, rough lumber. They did set up some mills there early on, and then started developing the place. They developed farms, and of course they took some of the some of the prime places along the Teton River there. And then established Driggs, the city of Driggs, a post office came later, a few years later. And most of these people were that, sorry, not most, most of the people in that first expedition were from the Salt Lake Valley. But the Mormons had been settling southeastern Idaho since, I don't know, the early 1870s at least. They started moving up into Preston, Idaho, and worked their way north. The dominant culture there, except for Pocatello, which was a railroad town, and Idaho Falls had had its own history as sort of a transfer place and place where people were coming to start farming and doing some trading there. And by the turn of the century, place was well established. The county seat, Fremont County, was in St. Anthony. People were seeing some commercial activity in the valley. You know, their stores were being built. The Driggs's built a hotel in town, but the connection to Salt Lake was still very strong. I read through one of the Driggs family's sons wrote a autobiography, and he talked about the number of apostles that would come up to Driggs to meet with his father. They'd come up, you know, I think sometimes they were coming up to go fishing. That's a fine area for fishing, but they came up and spoke at conferences, dedicated the new steakhouse, which I think was built in, maybe around 1910 or 12. And, you know, these were all prominent people, B.H. Roberts, Joseph Fielding Smith, David O. McKay. There were a bunch of them that made the trip up there. So the cultural ties were still strong to Salt Lake. But the place was developing and then really began to change after the arrival of the Oregon Short Line, which got into the Teton Valley in 1912, about 6 months after the trial of Ellington Smith. So, and by then there were a few cars in the valley, not many. Most people were still horse and buggy and all of that.
Okay. So it is, I mean, I have family up in southeastern Idaho, so, you know, who are there for generations. And one of the things that I think is ignored in Western history is the importance of irrigation. I mean, yeah. Irrigation sounds boring. It's just water, but water rights, property rights, who has access to water becomes a huge source of power. And I think I first learned that lesson when I was studying Mormon history and realized that Brigham Young strategically developed his own property at the gates of the water rights so he could control the water rights. And that still exists today with the church and the Great Salt Lake. And there's this whole thing with that. So this murder takes place over these issues. Why don't you tell us about that, the day the murder happens?
Yeah. So, my grandfather and Ellington Smith were near neighbors. They lived on opposite sides of the county road, and they'd been feuding for quite a while. Dispute over water seemed to be a significant part of that. There were other complications, but there was a spring that my grandfather's place was east of Smith's, and since it was on the east side of the valley, that meant it was closer to the mountain, so it was uphill. So there was a spring that produced a stream that they both used. My grandfather filed for the right on that spring. I know that Smith had to have found out that he'd filed. The application wasn't actually accepted until a month after my grandfather's murder. So you can see the timing gets pretty close here. My grandfather files for this right, and some weeks later, Smith shoots and kills him. But there are other complicating factors here, including the fact that grandfather was a school teacher. He taught Smith's daughter. And Smith's family claimed that my grandfather had made some unwarranted and not respectful advances to this young student who was about 14 or 15 at the time. So Smith hears about this the weekend before this murder. My grandfather walks a mile north from his place to irrigate a field he's rented. And while he's irrigating the field, Smith rides up, and that's when the murder happened.
And so this is kind of the start of the story, but really it's your grandfather murdered. You follow his murderer and the story of his arc throughout it. I'm curious, because you said earlier you had grown up hearing about his murder. What did you know about it? That's got to be interesting.
Yeah,
story to grow up with.
Right. No, I basically was told that, you know, it was over water. Smith killed him. There was he was convicted, sent to the pen in Boise, and I knew that later during one of these pardon applications, Smith's family had approached my grandmother at her house in the Teton Valley, asking her if she would support Smith's application for a pardon. He'd been in the pen at that time about 6 years, and was older. He was in his late 50s. He was suffering from rheumatism. He'd broken his arm. He said his arm was virtually useless by the summer of, or spring of 1917. He thought he'd suffered enough and wanted out. So people came over there to talk to him. That was the basics of what I knew. Then when Ellington Smith's great-granddaughter did this genealogical research, she grew up in the Teton Valley too. She knew some of my cousins, and she shared this information with them. So then we started hearing about this at family reunions, and you know, sort of the surprise was to hear that, like, oh, that this wasn't all this wasn't as clean as we all thought it had been. That my grandfather had been unfairly accused of stealing this man's water and shot and killed over it. And it turns out that things were much more complicated than that. You know, so you had questions of insanity on the part of the murderer. You had questions of improper behavior by the school teacher in Darby. All this stuff began to swirl. This is when I really started looking at some of these documents. That's when I knew that I needed to write a book about it, because I wanted to sort this out. And then in the course of writing that, then you realize that, oh, some of the extant tales about this murder were either extremely sketchy or completely off base. And so they're part of writing the book for me is feeling like I've corrected the record, the public record on what actually happened.
Let's talk about some of the ways that you dug into this, solving this mystery, the sources that you used. And I'm curious, you talk about there's a lot of myth around it. What myths did you end up busting here? What things surprised you the most?
Well, I think probably the biggest one as far as understanding the events was to discover that Smith had two farms in the valley. And getting back to irrigation, I knew there had been an irrigation project that affected this field that my grandfather was irrigating when he was killed. When I looked at that research, I discovered that Smith had been part of an effort in the mid to late 1890s to develop Darby Creek and use it to irrigate fields north of Darby Creek, and that he, in fact, had land there. So I was able to figure out, once I learned that he had a farm there, in addition to the farm across from my grandparents, I was able to figure out that he homesteaded first north of Rexburg at Idaho, and apparently sold or traded that farm for this other farm north of Darby Creek. And this was critical because my grandparents didn't didn't arrive in the Valley until 1906, but they took up their place. Then 3 years later, Smith moved in there and started complaining about my grandfather polluting his drinking water, on and on, which was significant because, of course, when he moved into the place across the county road, he had to know that that stream they both used to irrigate and feed their livestock and for their personal culinary use, he knew that it flowed through my grandfather's farmyard. And he had horses, cows, pigs, chickens. So it really made me understand that, okay, so this aspect of his argument that my grandfather was trying to harass him, Smith believed that my grandfather was conspiring with another fella to drive him off his property. That's the case he made at trial. And this made pretty clear to me that, well, he knew that the water that he wanted to use to drink was flowing through somebody else's barnyard. And so what, you know, the big question then, or the sort of the remaining question for me these days is like, well, why couldn't these two guys like figure this out? I mean, they knew how to pipe springs. They could have made it so that water got delivered to each house without it flowing through a farmyard. I mean, I don't know exactly how my grandfather routed the water to his house, but I'm sure he didn't. He took it to his house before it went through the farmyard, but Smith didn't bother with that. So that was, I guess not really busting a myth, but really finding a fact that was pretty critical to understanding their relationship and putting it into a context of, or at least a fuller context.
Do you feel like, this is just a personal curiosity, did that change the way that your family looked at this too, your research? Do you think that they were surprised?
That's a good question, because most of them didn't know it until I published this book this summer, and I haven't seen very many of them about that. I've got a cousin in Pocatello who was pretty interested to see all that, a brother up in McCall, who was sort of, he had no idea. And he wrote a story, a pamphlet of his own about the murder 25 years ago or so. And he had no idea that Smith had two farms. And I think he was far more willing to give credence to Smith's arguments that that Neil was polluting his water. So we'll see. You know, there'll be another reunion. I'll find out what they think of it.
Well, you and I were talking about this previously, but what role does polygamy have in this story? Where does that fit?
Well, it made the people who they are. I think that one of the reports I saw come out of the murder was this idea that after Smith's defense was presented, which really, the defense was set up to tear down the reputation of my grandfather. There was this idea that perhaps Smith would be acquitted by what they called the unwritten law. That is, a father standing up for the virtue of his daughter. So I wonder about this a little bit. I wonder if Smith might have seen some justification in this, and that, I mean, when you grow up around polygamy, you grow up knowing that, okay, this is officially against the law, but our higher law says that this is the way things should be. And so we can pretend that we acknowledge the existing law, but we don't really. And this showed up in the Upper Teton Valley in the one case I found of a fellow named Victor Hegstead. He lived in Salem, which, as I mentioned before, is the first place that Smith homesteaded, and where a number of his relatives had moved in the late 1880s. Hegstead was the bishop of one of the Salem wards. Well, and married. He, in 1904, perhaps 18 months previously, sort of started courting an instructor at Ricks College, Ricks Academy at the time. And in 1904, a month after what I think we all call the Second Manifesto, he married this Ricks College professor. Her name was Hannah Grover. He married her as his plural wife. Well, you can see how things were changing at the time, because shortly afterwards he was removed as bishop. So this was when, you know, there was all this conflict within the church, and including within the top leadership of the church, of whether they should continue to sanctify plural marriage. So Hickstead marries this woman. She loses her job at Ricks College also as a result of this marriage, and then retreats to the Salt Lake Valley, where he visits her. And over the next 10 years, they have three children. So, and his first wife had agreed to the plural marriage. So she knew about it. It wasn't like it was a secret from her. She died in, I think, 1914. Hickstead then civilly marries Hannah Grover, and they then move to Driggs. And then Hickstead later becomes one of the prominent people that advocated for the pardon of Ellington Smith. So, I mean, it's still polygamy still is functioning as an integral part of the culture there. You know, there are other things going on there, like, you know, the Driggs and Darby are right against the Wyoming state line. And I've up in Driggs at a presentation this past September, and a fellow there was telling me, they're like, oh, yeah, these guys, the polygamists that were living in the Teton Valley, several of them had cabins up Darby Canyon, which is over the state line in Wyoming, where when they were starting to feel a little legal pressure, they would go and spend time at their cabins while apparently they're, you know, Idaho was strongly opposed to polygamy, at least the people in Boise and the rest of the state. I mean, they passed some of the toughest laws against polygamy that I think forever made law. And this also makes me wonder if, like, given that division of thinking about it, the people that are thinking of themselves as the progressive aspect of the church and they want to put down polygamy, maybe some people called law people and lawmen and said, hey, you know, so-and-so's here living with two wives. You got to do something about it. And so then they would go hide out across the state line.
Well, that brings up another question about justice, because this podcast has been exploring the inconsistencies of mountain law, mountain justice. It is pretty inconsistent, and a lot of it is vigilante, you know, justice, people taking matters into their own hands. What did you learn about the landscape of justice during this time?
What I saw over this period was just the sort of evolution of penology in Utah and Idaho. I mean, you know, I have a picture of my great-grandfather in prison stripes as a cohabitant incarcerated at Utah Territorial Pen. By the time Smith goes to the state pen in Boise, the stripes are gone, and a new progressive warden has convinced people that, you know, most of these people are going to get out of jail at some point. We want them to be able to integrate into society. And so he started this idea of teaching them skills that could be useful once they're outside the pen. Bought a leased land for a prison farm. He had crews working out, building highways across Idaho, and generally trying to make sure that people, that inmates could make a living when they left. But the same controversy we have today over prisons, you know, are they for punishment? Are they for rehabilitation? Are they really both? How are we going to make them work? You see that those waves move back and forth. I mean, there was quite a drive to change sentencing law so that you could keep a person in jail until they proved that they had become a moral person and would obey the law, as opposed to, like, knowing you're going to get out in 5 years after you've committed a robbery. I mean, the theory there was that, like, yeah, you commit a robbery and you don't reform, you could be in jail the rest of your life for that. So it was interesting to see these debates go back and forth. Idaho would set up this pardons board, which became very controversial, as, you know, people would be pardoned and then they would go out and recommit crimes, and this put big pressure. Or there was a pardon of a former deputy state treasurer who had embezzled a bunch of money from the taxpayers, and he was pardoned and allowed out. Not exactly pardoned, I guess his sentence was shortened, and And that created quite a stir in the press in Idaho that, you know, who are these people to take the judgments of juries and completely reverse them? So it was a very interesting time, and this had a direct bearing on Smith's applications for pardon. I didn't see, you know, I got to say, it was interesting to see how Smith was arrested, the lack of concern for evidence. I mean, I think we're also steeped these days in these crime investigation shows. And, you know, I mean, the classic little line that struck me was Smith, as he's arrested, asking somebody to clean his rifle. That was the murder weapon. I mean, it was just left leaning against the door of his house. Anyway, there are some of these things that are striking, and it's just, you know, what we discover when we look back and in the past and just see that, oh, things have changed over time. We've got better ways of doing things. Hopefully better ways of doing things anyway.
When it comes to this being your family, how does that factor in writing a story? Often on this podcast, we kind of poke fun at the idea that Mormons want to look, you know, smilingly on their own ancestors, but not anyone else. And, you know, when I read this, your grandpa's kind of he is the victim in the story, but I wondered if you felt like he had any part in this, or he had some flaws or shadow sides that you didn't expect to dig up when you were looking for the research.
Oh, sure. I was a journalist for a long time, and I was sort of surprised when I started getting into this that, like, oh, I kind of want him to be fresh and innocent. You know, I don't want him to be flawed here. I want him to be completely undeserving of victimhood. I realized I'm a journalist. I know the journalistic process. There are many ways to try to eliminate subjectivity from a report. And one of the first things is trying to stay aware of your own biases. And so I knew that I had to be careful about how I wrote things. I also, had to fairly portray Smith's defense. And he mounted an insanity defense. He claimed my grandfather had been trying to drive him off his property. He said he was abusive. He threatened him, all this stuff. Maybe all that stuff happened. I suspect that, my grandfather was ambitious. He was, he was working as a school teacher to generate cash while they were trying to develop this land. I know he had aspirations of developing a bigger cattle ranch. He had friends. They were maybe trying to speculate on where the railroad might come into the valley. And so maybe they were looking to buy land. It's hard for me to come up with hard facts about all of that, but clearly it was part of the story. I had to recognize that he had his flaws like we all do. And maybe was abusive to Ellington Smith, maybe did threaten him, maybe did shout at him and tell him to, get out.
Although none of that would justify murder, of course.
Right. No. I mean, that's the key thing here is, I mean, we don't, you know, there's, for insanity to be proven, a person completely has to lose their sense of right and wrong. And, rage is not or anger is not a justification for taking someone's life.
Yeah, well, how did the families themselves feel? Do you know if the murder rippled out and affected, their women, children, your grandmother, your family? The
Well,
church,
I mean,
imagine sharing a ward together. That's crazy.
Right. I mean, so my grandmother was left with five children under age nine. My own father was just 15 months old. So she took him to her mother's place. Her mother had moved to the valley and was living somewhere relatively nearby. I'm not sure exactly where. My father went and lived with her for the next 6 years. She had to try to figure out how to meet the demands of this water permit application that she received a month after his death. She had to figure out how to make the homestead work. She had, I think, no cash income except for what she could get from selling butter, eggs, and helping farmers like pick raspberries. I mean, she had a rough go, and in my mind emerges as basically the heroine of the book. I mean, she held her family together, she held the farm together, and dealt with these worries that Smith was going to be freed from prison. Smith's children were basically orphaned by this. Their mother had died about 15 years before. They had two farms to run. I know that Smith's eldest son actually stayed on that farm opposite my grandparents' place until he died in the 1950s, and then his wife just walked away from it. I mean, life in the Teton Valley was always tough until I would say the last 30 years after the arrival of the ski hill and then the development of people wanting these big trophy homes out and around the Grand Tetons. So, yeah, they struggled. That both families struggled. What I was trying to get to. It was interesting to me to take the book over there this summer. You know, I mean, I'd informed the guy who owns the ranch opposite my grandparents' place that I was working on this. And he just said to me, he says, "I don't know why people can't let a dead dog alone." When I approached the museum in the Teton Valley about this, and they said, "Well, you know, there are a lot of people that are going to be upset by bringing this back up again." So there's still, you know, there still are some of the old families around there. I mean, I worked with Susan Foster, the woman who discovered her family's history back in the 70s. I worked with her fairly closely on this, and she wanted to hear the story too. And I think, well, I know she's been excited about it because I've had people come to various signings over there in southeastern Idaho that are related to her. So,
well, why don't you make an argument for us why people should care about Idaho Western history, especially in Mormon history?
Well, I mean, you know, Mormon history is an undeniable part of the West. I mean, if you think of it on the grand scale, you know, the history of the West largely was a history of boom and bust, of South Pass booms and then becomes a ghost town. Helena booms, almost becomes a ghost town. There are these Nevada's full of ghost towns. But in central Utah and, you know, the Brigham's old state of Deseret, which extended up into southeastern Idaho and western Wyoming, you had a very steady community. It was not boom and bust. Not that they didn't have their up and downs economically, but those people were rooted here and they didn't leave when things went bad economically. They stuck it out. And that happened up in the Teton Valley and the Upper Snake River Valley. I mean, those people stayed. They've made the place what it is today, you know, for better or worse. And I think if you want to understand how those places have become what they are, you have to know this history.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's kind of an untapped frontier, if you will, for Mormon historians. But a lot of good stuff is happening, as John Dinger has brought to my attention. I mean, he really got me interested in this history of this area years ago when I was doing the Year of Polygamy podcast, when I learned about the post-manifesto reaction and how whole Idaho stakes were being excommunicated for polygamy so they could go vote and then be rebaptized. I mean, just crazy stuff. And that's just one component of it. And I really do feel like the more you get into the wilderness, the crazier the stories get, as you know, with living in Wyoming as well. It is still a frontier, and the Teton Valley, like you said, it's now considered a place for the wealthy, but it wasn't too long ago that it was so isolated and hidden that it was dangerous, and scarcity was a real thing. And what people do under those conditions makes for really good stories and history for historians to dig through. So
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it was remote country, and there were bandits there. You know, the members of the Shoshone tribe still were migrating through there into the early 20s, you know, taking the, you know, my dad had stories of watching some, as he said, Indians, you know, walking single file past their barn as they made their way up the Darby Canyon and up into the Tetons and beyond. I mean, it was really a place in transition and didn't become fully integrated into the economy, I would say, until the at least 1912 when the short line came there. You know, otherwise, I mean, they had to haul stuff by wagon to Rexburg or St. Anthony to be able to get their crops to market. You know, the economy was isolated. They took care of one another in terms of trading things for other things they needed. It's a really interesting place to look at.
Well, just a few more questions before I let you go. What do you hope your book will be, readers will get out of your book? What do you want your readers to walk away with?
Well, I think first of all, I want them to walk away knowing that these were real people who led tough lives. One of the things I knew but still was surprised by was to see how these epidemics would move through, you know, before the days of vaccines. You know, there is a famous guy up there, Beaver Dick Lee, who lost 8 members of his family in a period of about 10 days to smallpox. In the 1890s, early 91, 92, a diphtheria epidemic went through the Upper Valley and took many, many children's lives and a few adults. So I want people to know that these were people struggling with over money, struggling to clear land. They were struggling to deal with the loss of children, loss of loved ones, and I want people to see that their lives were fulfilling and that they worked hard to, I think, honor their own moral values. I mean, I think my grandmother certainly was sustained by her belief in the church. I think it helped her a lot. I assume people helped her in ways that I don't know about. She had relatives up there that certainly did. So yeah, I guess I want people to take away this idea that, you know, these were real human beings who we can relate to deeply.
If you could talk to your grandfather, David S. Neal, or Ellington Smith or his family, what would you say? What would you ask?
I think with my grandfather, I'd want to say, well, why couldn't you guys work this out? I mean, I specifically would want to ask him, were these allegations that you tried to drag Mabel Smith, Ellington Smith's daughter, off into the bushes, were those true? I mean, I would want to know that. I'd want to ask my grandmother how she possibly did it. I still don't know how she managed to hold things together, really. I'd like to ask Ellington Smith if he made up these allegations against my grandfather that his daughter's school teacher tried to engage with her in a way he never should have. I'd like to know about that. I would like to ask Mabel, who was only 14 or 15 years old when she testified against my as part of the case to tear down my grandfather's reputation. I'd like to know if her father directed her to make those comments.
Yeah, I mean, some mysteries we just can never know, but your book does explore them. And so I would encourage everyone to read them without giving further spoilers. You learn, at least for me, I learned a lot about the landscape that they were living in, how people reacted to these charges. And I dare say care more about irrigation and property rights than they do about ideas of sexual assault or impropriety. It's just interesting to see the values too and what matters most under color of law. So thank you so much for writing it. Where can people get your books? I would, of course, recommend Benchmark Books, but
Benchmark has copies. The number of bookstores in southeastern Idaho have it. Winnie and Moe's, a couple down in Pocatello. They can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or from the publisher, which is Wordsworth Publishing up in Cody. Yeah, I'm hoping that people get it, read it, and I hope they'll find it a good read.
Yeah, and we'll link it up there on our website, but just for those who need to hear the title again, it's No Forgiveness, Family, Polygamy, Murder, and Justice Among Idaho's Pioneering Mormons. So we'll link it up there. And how can folks get a hold of you if they have questions?
My email is, you want me just to lay this out?
Go ahead and lay it out, and then we'll link it as well.
Okay. danealcker@gmail.com. Yeah, I'd be happy to hear from people there. I think they could also leave comments with Wordsworth Publishing up in Cody, but I read my email.
Well, it was a delight to read. You're clearly a good writer. Sarah speaks very highly of your journalism and the good work that you've done there and the fights and the underdogs that you've helped in Wyoming. So just from both of
Sarah,
us, thank you.
Sarah's got a big job herself. I appreciate her support very much.
Yeah, we'll just throw that out there. If you want to help Equality Orgs, Wyoming needs your help. It's one of the hardest places to fundraise for LGBT equality. So we'll throw that out there too. Buy the book and support Wyoming Equality.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dan, for coming on and for sharing this story and for doing this research. What are you working on now?
Oh man, I'm working on trying to market this silly book, but I've got a couple projects in mind. Haven't really plunged in yet. I mean, there's part of me that just wants to sit back and read for a few months. So there you are.
Yeah, well, if anyone out there has a bookstore or wants to promote a really cool murder mystery on the frontier, this is your place to do it. So thanks again, Dan, and we'll throw the information up on our website and link, and everyone go out there and support his great work.
Thanks, Lindsay. I appreciate it very much.
Offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.